Buonasera a tutti, benvenuti a Biennale Tecnologia, benvenuti a questa sessione. Io sono Ciro Cattuto, sono un professore di informatica presso l'Università di Torino e un principal scientist presso Fondazione ISI, sempre a Torino. E questa sera ho l'onore e l'autentico piacere di presentare un ospite eccezionale di Biennale Tecnologia, il professor David Gruber, in questo incontro che si intitola 20.000 leghe sotto i mari. David Gruber è una delle persone più brillanti che abbia mai incontrato nella mia vita, una delle menti più interdisciplinari, aperte ed audaci. Nei prossimi 2 minuti vorrei presentarvelo, prima di cedergli la parola. Il professor David Gruber, è professore presidenziale di scienze biologiche ed ambientali presso il Baruch College, della City University di New York, a New York, Stati Uniti. Ed è anche un National Geographic Explorer. In termini di formazione, si è laureato presso l'Università del Rhode Island, poi ha preso un master in giornalismo, una laurea in giornalismo presso Columbia University a New York, un master in management ambientale da Duke University e poi ha fatto un dottorato in biologia marina presso l'Università di Rutgers. Ha lavorato per alcuni anni come postdoc presso l'Università di Brown, è stato fellow del Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Studies dell'Università di Harvard ed è attualmente anche fellow presso la Scuola di Medicina dell'Università di Yale. Il professor Gruber è famoso per molti motivi, ma una delle sue achievement, una delle sue riconoscimenti più forti deriva dalla scoperta di oltre 180 specie di organismi marini bioluminescenti che emettono luce in uno spettro non visibile all'occhio umano. Questa scoperta nel 2014 fu riportata, ha avuto molta risonanza, è stata riportata dal New York Times, dal National Geographic, è risultata in un TED Talk del professor Gruber. Molto, molto popolare. E dal 2005, scusate, dal 2015 il professor Gruber ha iniziato a collaborare con il laboratorio di microrobotica dell'Università di Harvard, sviluppando dei robot particolarmente gentili al tatto che vengono utilizzati per catturare e studiare organismi delicati come le meduse ed altri organismi di questo genere. Vi ho detto che il professor Gruber è una mente particolarmente interdisciplinare. Per darvi un senso di questo, tenete presente che questo anno ha presentato insieme a John Jonas una mostra presso la Biennale di Venezia, in quello che era l'Ocean Space, lo spazio dell'oceano, presso la Biennale della Venezia, di Venezia. Il professor Gruber ha anche ricevuto molti, molti premi. Nel 2006 è stato premiato per il miglior articolo scientifico scritto su New Yorker. Nel 2014 è stato nominato dalla National Geographic Society un Emerging Explorer, un esploratore emergente, e nel 2014 è anche diventato Fellow dell'Explorers Club di New York. Nel 2016 è stato lo speaker per la cena annuale dell'Explorer Clubs, che è un evento particolarmente prestigioso, e per venire vicini a Torino nel 2019 gli è stato conferito il premio Lagrange per la scienza della complessità da Fondazione ISI e Fondazione CRT. Questo anno, e siamo molto contenti di avere il professor Gruber con noi proprio questo anno, perché questo anno il professor Gruber ha vinto un altro premio straordinario, che è il TED Audacious Project. È un premio conferito da TED per i progetti particolarmente audaci. Come presidente del progetto CETI, CETI sta per Cetacean Translation Initiative, iniziativa di traduzione della lingua dei cetacei. Quello che il professor Gruber fa, fra le altre cose, è provare a usare l'intelligenza artificiale per dialogare con i capodogli. E spero di avervi incuriosito su questo lavoro, sono estremamente eccitato di cedere la parola al professor David Gruber. David, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Ciro. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I will share my screen now. Well, first off, it's thank you, Ciro, and thank all the organizers of this conference. It's a pleasure to be part of this Biennale, And I'm here today to talk a little bit about some of my work under the sea and a little bit about who I am as a mareologist. So this was actually a year around this time, coming back from an expedition from Greenland. And you can see this was one of the more remote places on eastern Greenland, where we had a little camp here. And our desire here was to study the diversity of fish under the ice. So me, I'm coming to this as a tropical biologist who mainly dove in warm water. So this was a bit of a crazy experience for me. And that's me on the left, and John Sparks, the head of ichthyology at the American Museum of Natural History, on the right. And I guess doing crazy thing is something that has been a part of my history. This is testing out a one-person submarine suit that is capable of diving to 330 meters. And this is also filming the BBC shark documentary that had come out, looking for novel features among sharks at night. But in Greenland, there was something so special about diving underneath the ice. And for me, this was my first time in the Arctic. And to get to experience this in some of the remote places to dive and to explore the fish diversity, I was really surprised at how few marine biologists had been there. But what really struck me is the sound. So this is the sound. Of the ice melt, and, I feel like this is the thing that really stood out for me from this trip here, is realizing how quickly the change was occurring at the poles of the Earth, and just taking that in. While it was so fascinating to be exploring under the ice, the feeling of that there will probably not be ice there in the decades to come really, really kind of hit me hard. And there's something among National Geographic that the other explorers that get to go, really fortunate to get to go to coral reefs in the most remote places in the world, or diving under the ice in Greenland, but to be able to really see with our own eyes some of the change that is occurring. The word solastalgia, which is the distress that is produced by environmental change impacting on people while they're directly connected to their home environment. It's a little bit like nostalgia, but it's the home disappearing. And this is a word the explorers have been talking more about. And as scientists, there's this idea that we're the eyes, and we're seeing things that are the first people to be noticing these. And we're trying to communicate these things with the rest of our species and tell them what we're seeing. And there's also sometimes a feeling like we're just not being heard, and the message is not coming out loud enough, and that the scientists don't have a voice. So I feel I'll talk a little bit now about some of my work, and Chiro mentioned how I've been working with artists lately, and seeing my science as a bit of an art project where I'm picking up distinct themes. So one theme is really trying to understand how marine creatures perceive the world around them. You know, how does a fish see? How does a shark see? How does a turtle see the world? And this idea of investing so much time to get behind the eye of an animal, a marine creature, and spending several years, you know, feeling what this animal would feel, really has an impact on me as a scientist and some of the people in the teams that I've worked with. So, as Chiro mentioned, I work on bioluminescence and biofluorescence. And this was really a lucky finding that had happened to me and my colleagues in 2014. We had discovered over 200 new species of fluorescent fish. And this was very exciting for us, because what we're doing here is we are examining the fish through their blue world, because the ocean is blue, we would swim with blue lights and look for fish that were actually taking that blue light and transforming this out as other colors. So this was something that was quite new before 2014, and it had been known in corals, but not in fish. And one of the more striking animals that we found fluorescence in was this swell shark, which striking to me, but it wasn't the species of shark that was making it on television. It's a very shy species, only about 1 meter long, and basically just lays on the bottom, very, very inconspicuous. But when you shine these lights on it, this is some of the first footage that we've taken of the biofluorescence in swell sharks. It was able to see this whole new set of patterns emerging in these animals. And so this first off just starts out as a scientific question, like, wow, what does this mean? It's very interesting that blue ocean light is creating this transformation, but how does the shark see? Can the shark see this? What does it mean to the shark? So we first, this was the swell shark that we began examining. And one way to first get the idea is to look at the eyes and to examine the eyes of the shark and to see what color is the shark seeing and how does this compare to a human shark, a human eye. And for this shark, it had one visual pigment in its eye. Unlike a human, we have three, a red, green, and blue. This shark only had one pigment, and it was right around in the blue-green. But also what you're seeing here on the right are the rods in the eye, and they're much longer than humans, so it's really good for low light detection. So just by seeing this, we know now that this shark is really good at seeing in the dark, much better than a human, and that it's seeing one color, like black and white, but instead of black and white, it's seeing blue and green. So now, the next step is once we knew how the shark eyeball was constructed, was to modify a camera. So we turn this camera into a shark eye camera that is configured into how a shark would see. And we think of how all the cameras are developed today. They're developed for humans. They're made so we can see. You know, if a shark was to make a camera, it would make a camera very different for their eye. So this is using the shark eye camera and swimming in the shark's environment and finding the shark in its home and then shooting it with the shark camera. And what we were able to find out is that the property of biofluorescence allows the shark to actually see greater contrast among each other. So since they can see blue-green and the ocean is blue, as they go even deeper down, there's only blue. They're transforming blue into green where there's not green and creating this contrast color that allows them to see the patterns in other sharks better than non-fluorescent objects. And when we looked even further, there was the males and the females had different patterns in them. So these are things that wouldn't be seen under regular light, but under the fluorescence lens, there is special patterns that were hidden there. And another thing was when we dove even deeper into the chemistry of this, that there was even among the shark's skin, which is called the dermal denticles, some of the denticles were using this fluorescence as a lightsaber, and some of them weren't. So being as a way to actually project the light. And we were to show last year the full suite of showing that the sharks are fluorescent, they can see it, there are male-female patterns, and this is the chemistry of how the shark is making it. It's using a brominated tryptophan to create this, and which is very different than jellyfish and corals, which are using something called green fluorescent protein. But then things got really crazy in 2015 when this sea turtle presented itself to the team. And this was the first time that we now see that turtles, marine turtles, there's only 7 species of marine turtles, and we're finding that that at least 3 or 4 of them are already fluorescent. This is the hawksbill turtle. And So first is the way a scientist does things is we first make this first observation that telling the rest of the science community that we have found fluorescence in marine turtles. But the next step is even more fun for me, is to begin to get behind the eye of the turtle, to see the world from the turtle's perspective. So this is using an eye chart against the turtle. And then it's just showing the lens that we go to. We now need to see the color. So we put instruments in the water to measure the exact color of the water. And then this is still in process with scientist Derya Arkayak. We have been designing a special camera with hyperspectral imaging that is tuned to the lens of the turtle. So we will be able to have an idea of how the turtle is seeing the world and what it means to be a fluorescent turtle. So again, this is thinking about this journey of learning, making an observation, and then going deeper and deeper and deeper into the species in a way to connect to it. Another one was looking at flashlight fish, which are these really, really magical fish. They're one of the most magical fish I've ever seen. And here is the flashlight fish. And there's something very unique about this fish as opposed to other fish, is that this organ under its eye, where it grows bioluminescent bacteria that glow blue, and it's even built a structure of veins to provide oxygen to the bacteria, and it flushes them out and it allows the bacteria to glow. So it's almost like a garden where it's growing a special crop of bioluminescent bacteria. And then they have like a little windshield wiper that goes up and down that allows them to turn the light on and off by putting a shade over the light. So this was a island in the South Pacific that that we were swimming on at night, and we were actually looking at the fluorescence when all of a sudden we come across this. You know, it was, I think as a scientist, there's been these few moments in my career where they just really stand out as moments that were so special. And just imagine swimming in this water on a really remote island with a few crocodiles around and suddenly seeing thousands of bioluminescent fish that are blinking and flashing, and they were making shapes and coming together and almost looking like a blue road or a river of blinking lights moving around was really incredible, incredibly special. But now the next thing, and here is a little bit of what it looks like to see those fish underwater. So now we went back and we filmed this with a very special camera with Brennan Phillips. And this is a very special low light camera that allows you to detect single photons and be able to look at the data in a much deeper layer. And once we collected this much more scientific imagery, we were able to really analyze what was happening among the chaos, or what seemed like chaos. But we were seeing that there was fish that were swimming together, almost like in a ballet, and they were blinking at the same time and moving about, keeping the same space between them. And we also noted that there was some fish that we called the motivated fish that were leading the direction of the entire group. And this leads me to think of, you know, understanding these fish so well, can we someday make a robotic fish that can join the community of these fish in a way that the fish think this is one of their own? Can we ever get to a level of understanding of that great? But now the other theme that I think about in my research is gentleness and this concept of engineering the future. And this concept came about in two ways. In one way, in 2014, when I was at National Geographic and I was showing a video of how I was working from a submarine with a metal claw. And in the audience was Robert Wood, who is the professor at Harvard who runs the the Harvard Microrobotics Lab, and he presented to me the idea of using soft robotics or gentle robots as a new way for marine biologists to work underwater. And this is some of the ways things are done in the past. You know, these are these really rough, rigid claws. And there are some sponges that can be 18,000 years old. 18,000 years old, like the deep sea and space take on a whole nother level, things that we don't even understand. So our response to this was to design one of the most gentle robots in the world. So this is an ultra gentle robot that was designed by a student, Nina Sinatra from Harvard, and part of her PhD thesis. And we then testing this on an animal that most people don't even care about, a jellyfish, you know, a very soft animal, but something we don't think about, like, do jellyfish feel stress? So we did an experiment using the most gentle robots, and we wanted to see if there was a difference in how the jellyfish respond to being held by a traditional gripper versus this gentle robot. And we used, it's called next generation sequencing, where we look at all of the genes that are being expressed. And we first did something on the left with no stress. So you can see there's not much change in the expression of genes when it's under no stress. And then we used the soft robotic fingers, and we see they did a little bit of change, but then with the rigid claw and then with high stress, you can actually see the difference in a jellyfish noticing the stress response to how it's being handled. So this was exciting for us because it was really our first proof of concept that even animals with a neural net, not even a centralized nervous system like a human, respond to the gentle robots in a better way. So we've been continuing on in this process in designing ultra gentle fingers, and now thinking of how the future marine biologists will work. And the idea is to be in a submarine at night and to be able to have soft robotic arms outside the submarine so that a scientist could gently almost do laboratory experiment at the bottom of the ocean, causing the least impact and not even bringing the animals to the surface. So we've now implemented this dream of an idea on the OceanX submarine recently, testing this out on novel creatures, just showing that this is a process that can work. So it's really so new, this research, really just showing that we can start making objects that are much more gentle. Here is another idea of how to study animals at sea. This is called a rotary actuated dodecahedron, which is a flat sheet of paper. When using the concepts of origami, it will fold by one turning device. It will fold and form this sphere. So in this scenario, we can actually encompass a jellyfish in the deep sea and then open it and let the jellyfish go. And while it's in there, we could be doing research and studies on this. Thinking of where to go in the future here is to combine like 3D imaging, do genomics just by touching, a little bit like a DNA swab that they're doing now for the COVID test. If you just swab the animal, you can learn quite a bit about it. Even do classification of the animals, be able to do new species identification in the deep sea, and then ultimately let the animal go and not bring it to a surface, because when the animal is carried to the surface, it ultimately is never brought back down. So it's a one-way journey for this that leads in mortality. And the thinking is to really bring the concept of gentleness and respect to the marine creatures. In another sense of how we're doing this, when we use submarines in the deep sea, we've been exploring ultra low light imaging, because imagine in the deep sea, below 700 meters, there's no sunlight whatsoever. So the only light is this dim bioluminescent light. So when we go there with big bright lights in a submarine, it's very, very disturbing to the animals. So we've designed a system so we can bring an incredibly low light camera. For people who know about cameras, it's over 4 million ISO. And it now allows the submarine and the remotely operated vehicle drivers to be able to work at just a fraction of 1% the normal light. So be able to go down there in a much more gentle, dim fashion. And here is using this, you could now see the bioluminescence. And this was in a recent encounter on the research vessel Nautilus, where we found a species of jellyfish called Deepstaria enigmatica that has only been seen several times. And by capturing it with this system, we were able to get a really unique view of this jellyfish in its own environment. And in the same time, we were able to capture the image of the vampire squid in a way where we're using almost a small pen light of light, which is illuminating the scene, and be able to see the behavior of this vampire squid in a way that we've not been able to see this before. You know, and in conclusion, this talk is about presenting these ideas of the future, of engineering a future of gentleness. And as we think of technology, to keep in mind that the humans are in control of the technology, and that if we're designing technology that we feel is harmful, that ultimately we are the ones behind this, we're driving this, and to think a little bit more about how we want to have a future with technology. And then also think about seeing from other species perspective and using this incredible technology that we have now to be able to see the world from other species' eyes. You know, using all of the new techniques and technology, we can channel this energy towards really feeling what another animal is seeing and seeing what they're seeing. And really the ultimate idea here is that as we enter this period of really unprecedented change, where we're in an experiment ourselves, can we connect to nature and change our mindsets in time to create a really better future for humans and reverse the sixth extinction? And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. Grazie mille al professor David Gruber. Direi che abbiamo ampio spazio per delle domande, quindi vi ricordo che su Slido è possibile postare delle domande. Al momento non ne vedo, direi. E quindi inizierò io con una domanda. David, while we wait for the audience to come up with some questions, I'm sure there will be many. Can you tell us more about your own trajectory in science? I know we have many students and we have many educators following us. So a recurrent theme has been to understand what we can do better to teach kids and young scholars to approach problems such as the ones you tackle that require multiple hats, multiple competencies, a very different view from what normally schools and universities provide us. So I think it would be very valuable for this audience if you could share your own path into this and how you see this moving forward as well.
Yeah, thank you. My own path, really, I guess it came from just one step at a time. And I think for the students, I could never reinforce how important it is to get the foundations, to really just understand, you know, basic biology, basic chemistry, basic physics, because it's an endless journey of finding the interconnections between all these fields. And there is something special about the ocean where they all really come together. There's the biology in the ocean, there's the physics of the ocean, there's the geology of the ocean. And it's just continuing, starting with the foundations, and it just goes on forever. You know, in one sense, I don't think there's ever an end to these journeys. And there's so many fascinating things to study that it just takes the focus of what catches your eye. And I always think sometimes when I go into a lab and they're studying mice or they're studying a cockroach, you know, for them, that's the most beautiful thing in the world and they find real beauty. So I would encourage students to one, really study something that they're just absolutely fascinated in finding beauty in what they study, that they would want to study this or work on this, even if they weren't getting paid, and to also try to have fun with it. You know, in one sense, I feel there is a joy in work and how we learn. And, you know, even though it's serious and it's robots and science, and to step back and be a kid and be a child and be curious about things. Why does it do that? And I think that's one of the things is the most difficult for scientists as they continue to move forward, is to still keep that kind of child in them alive.
Thank you very much. We start to have a few questions. Ne leggerò una. La domanda è, grazie mille, molto affascinante. Che cosa si intende per sesta estinzione?
It's a great question.
Translated, David.
So what we're talking about here is that in the last 550 million years, there's been five major extinction events. And the one that you're probably most familiar with is the Cretaceous Tertiary 65 million years ago. And that is when the dinosaurs went extinct. And there are examples of moments where the extinction rates go over 90%. And this one, there's fairly conclusive evidence of a bolide impact that caused this. As we go back, there's a really big one called the Permian Triassic around 245 million years ago. But what we're seeing now is we're in this area now of the last 150 years since humans have really been harnessing technology intensely and burning fossil fuels, the rates of extinction have begun to reach the same levels that they've been in the previous five extinctions right now. So because these things are thought about in deep time, you know, millions of years, you know, really deep time, we're living in the sixth extinction right now, and it's happening, but it's not happening on a rate that seems immediate. You know, it's happening over a decade or several decades. So we're starting to see more and more of the impacts of this. And a lot of the scientists are recognizing this and just thinking of, you know, what to do. Is it reversible? How can we prevent almost like what would appear to be a slow motion car crash, where you're watching something happen in almost like a time frame. But if you study things over millions of years, you really see how impactful humans have been on biological cycles and species in the last 150 years.
Thank you, David. And we start to have really many questions. So I will read a few. I will read them in Italian and then they will be translated to you as we go. La prima domanda è, si potrebbe approfondire il concetto di solastalgia?
Can I develop the notion? Well, I pose the idea, the notion is the feeling that the home is changing or is endangered. It's a little bit like nostalgia, where you're yearning for something in the past. the idea of solastalgia is like an existential feeling that the home is changing in a way. And I found this word very interesting because I didn't know of this word until I heard some of the other explorers at National Geographic using this word. And it really captured something that I was feeling. And I think that it's the people that are at the front lines, that are diving under the ice or that are looking at the coral reefs very carefully, starting to notice the change occurring. And maybe everybody's seen some of this. And, you know, just having a kind of feeling of, you know, of feeling that the home is disappearing and what to do with that energy. And I think for me, I'm manifesting that energy as a way to apply to my science, to make gentle robots and to see the world from other species perspectives, but everybody's interpreting it in their own way.
Grazie David. E, facendo seguito a questo mi connetta un'altra domanda che leggo riguardo proprio l'approccio gentile, l'idea di gentle robotics. E, la domanda è più che una domanda è un invito a riflettere sul fatto che quando facciamo ricerca è necessario rispettare anche la bellezza e la delicatezza della vita che studiamo. Qual è la tua opinione a riguardo il rapporto fra ricerca e bellezza?
I love that. Beautiful question. Beauty and research. Well, you know, in one sense, you could be a scientist and still see the deep sea as a piece of great art is one way that I see it. It for me, it's swimming in these places. It's the same feeling I have when I'm around, you know, great art, and, you know, just this great appreciation for the complexity and the beauty and the wonder of this. But I also feel that with the soft robotics, it's moving in a direction, it's an intention, and it's an intention to reinvent the old techniques with more respect. And at the same time, I feel that there's a great contrast to, you know, this line of research versus deep sea mining or commercial fishing, where they're just dragging nets across the bottom of the ocean. You know, I know as scientists, we do have an impact, but our impact is very small compared to these larger industrial behaviors that are occurring. So in one sense, I see this soft robotic as an intention and a direction for robotics and marine biologists in the future.
Grazie mille. Continuando su questa linea, un'altra domanda chiede, pensi che ci potrebbe essere dello spazio per sviluppare una ricerca in biologia marina che possa essere più vicina alle persone, più vicina agli studenti, qualcosa di più facilmente sperimentabile, una sorta di rete di laboratori diffusi, qualcosa che porti questa ricerca più vicina a chi magari è a scuola?
So, if I'm understanding the question, is that how to make this more accessible. One way to think about how we can make it accessible is to make everything open source. And for one sense, we could be collecting the information and building a platform that allows people at home to be working on the data in the same way and offering tutorials. Yeah, that is an excellent point. And Shiro mentioned a project that we're starting on whale biology, where we're intending to do exactly that, build the capacity for students to join us on this journey. So that's something I've also been thinking about, and is a wonderful question, and how to get more people involved and integrated to the research is important. So thank you.
Grazie. E un'altra domanda che ricorre in diverse forme è Quali possono essere le implicazioni, l'impatto sulla tecnologia, la medicina, applicazioni alla vita di tutti i giorni dei risultati di questa ricerca, di quello che stiamo imparando?
Yeah, what are the applications on everyday life? In one sense, bioluminescence and biofluorescence has provided researcher with tools such as a green fluorescent protein that's been used to illuminate genes and allowed many breakthroughs in science. And it was awarded the Nobel Prize in 2008 in chemistry just for the discovery and development of that. So that's one tangible example of the uses. But I think in one sense, we shouldn't always be looking for how does it, you know, benefit us in a way, because we're interconnected to the life. So by better understanding the life for its own purpose and work to preserve and understand it, that alone is also important to actually study some of these things while they're still here and with us.
C'è anche una domanda che so che il professor Gruber gradirà. Una persona sta chiedendo, pensa che l'intelligenza artificiale potrà essere utilizzata per guardare meglio al mondo dal punto di vista animale? Credo di conoscere la risposta.
The question is about using artificial intelligence to, I mean, in one sense, the technology is a tool. And it's a tool that allows us to explore and go deeper. So if we think of Darwin, you know, what would Darwin do if he had AI at his fingertips? And he did such, you know, interesting science with just his own eyeballs. But I think that having the power of AI, which really relates to the power of finding deep patterns, really does offer the potential for amazing new insights in the natural world, looking at communication patterns that are unlike human communication patterns. If we can harness the power of this to build the data sets that are appropriate for AI, I think it could it can really allow us to understand animal in new ways. So yeah, I'm very excited on how it can be used, but I'm also cautious in a sense that, you know, with many new technologies that are very powerful, it's our responsibility to, you know, to make sure that we use them in ways that are delicate and kind to the animals.
Grazie mille. Un'altra domanda più tecnica è, abbiamo visto molti organismi bioluminescenti, considerando che i capodogli vanno molto in profondità, dall'audience arriva la domanda, è immaginabile o sappiamo che i capodogli utilizzano la bioluminescenza essi stessi?
We don't know. There's actually only one paper so far that even thinks about this, and we know that the whales dive to depths of almost, you know, of a mile down, and in these places there is no light, but they there is bioluminescence. Are they using it? Where we don't have any observations yet to answer that question, but my feeling would be yes, likely.
Grazie. E altre domande attaccano il problema e sono state stimolate in una direzione simile. Ci sono molte domande che chiedono in forma diversa cosa stiamo imparando che si applichi ad altri oceani, in altri pianeti. Stiamo anche imparando qualcosa che probabilmente ci dà indicazioni sulla vita in altri ambienti, oltre al nostro pianeta.
Or we're learning things that we can use for other planets. Well, there is an entire field of astrobiology, which is very much microbial-based in one way, because we have extremophile microbes that can live under very, very challenging conditions in intense salt or intense heat. So there are a lot of what I think this person is asking is being done related to microbiology and astrobiology. At the moment, I think that's the extent of it. As we look for life on other planets, we've not gone beyond microbial forms at the current moment.
Grazie mille. E infine una domanda che probabilmente è una di quelle più importanti. L'osservazione del comportamento di questi organismi, quello che stiamo imparando sull'oceano, come ci sta aiutando, come ci può aiutare per proteggere il nostro ecosistema e prevenire la sesta estinzione? Cos'è che possiamo fare di più, anche da cittadini?
That's a wonderful question. What can we do, or how can this information help us? I think as a scientist and as a citizen, you know, we all feel helpless to this larger things that are happening. You know, what can I do? And I ask myself that question, and I just I think, one, we should be gentle on ourselves and realize that we can do, if we can each do what we can, and to also think of the gentleness that no species has ever been in such a situation where they have to self-regulate. There's not been an instance where the sharks had to come together in the ocean and decide how the sharks should live. So this entire moment is very new. And in one sense, we should feel gentle and kind with ourselves, but at the same time, humans and what we can do with technology, everybody knows that it's amazing, and how quickly it's moving, and how quickly we're now talking. I'm talking to you from New York and to Italy almost instantaneously by video. Is something that one or two generations ago would have thought you were crazy. So I think that we could engineer and create any future that we desire with technology, and that the moment now is to kind of create that vision of what we want it to look like, and ask ourselves, like, what do we want the world to look like in 50 years, in 100 years? And then the scientists can have a goal of things to create. So I think in one sense, just being the, you know, the best person they can and doing what they can do, as well as, you know, thinking about the future vision.
That is wonderful. Thank you. Fantastico. Grazie mille. David, I think we have time for one last question, and I would like to keep it as open as possible. In the sense, can you share with the audience, we have many people connected right now, can you share what is one dream of yours going forward, you know, like some very high ambition, that you have as a scientist and as a communicator and as an environmentalist?
I think my ambition is to inspire people to think that it's not too late. Anything is possible. And, you know, as humans, we're good and bad, but ultimately I think we're all good. You know, we're all born as babies wanting, you know, not wanting to destroy the world. You know, we all have an inherent goodness in us. So I think the idea is also, like, we get inspired by science fiction, and then the science fiction becomes real. So I think it's the idea of painting the picture of the future we'd like, and just thinking about that, you know, each person separately, how would they like the world to be in 50 years? And even just putting thought into that, you know, allows you to see beyond what's right in front of you and to see bigger things. So I think that would be something that I'd hope this research does.
That's great, and we are almost running out of time. Let me check if we have any questions. We still have like 4 or 5 minutes. No, I think that in terms of questions, like they are very similar to questions you already asked. I would like to give you, if you want to have some closing comments, like 2-3 minutes to share any other idea, any other thing that you think would be interesting for the audience.
I think I think it was great. I really enjoyed. I enjoyed. This is a new presentation, so many of these ideas are very fresh and have come about during the pandemic. So, I think that I'm really just happy to have had this opportunity to see you again, Shiro, and to share this new research and to think about the research, which I didn't think about much today, but pertains to the whales.
Excellent. Beh, grazie mille, questa è stata una conversazione molto interessante. Ringraziamo il professor David Gruber non solo per il suo contributo, ma anche per la sua generosità nel rispondere a così tante domande per così tanto tempo. Quindi vorrei con questo semplicemente ringraziare tutti voi per essere stati qui con noi questa sera, in questo ultimo giorno di Biennale Tecnologia. Vorrei ringraziare il professor David Gruber per il suo contributo ancora una volta e ringraziare voi tutti per la partecipazione, inclusi gli organizzatori di Biennale Tecnologia. Buona serata.